not pictured as a Christian dying for his faith or just nuts. And in my opinion, the vast, vast majority of the kind of Christians we're creating, the kind of Christians we're doing, are going to be absolutely unable to stand up to that kind of stuff. I think not 2%, not 3% of Christians are sure. In any way, face that kind of struggle. I hope I'm wrong about that. I think less than half of our students are support Bible college. This is the surrounding of the camp of the saints. This is the battle. This is it. I mean, it's going to look like a battle. You get my point? It's going to be very subtle and gradual. Mass, camouflage, misidentified, misunderstood, misrepresented. And by the way, if you don't think states can do this, do you realize that often, you know, the Germans are often condemned. The German nation is roundly condemned for what happened to the Jews. As a matter of fact, the German population did not know what was happening. They simply did not know. It was done so subtly, so gradually, and with such finesse, they did not know. Now, many of you did. Many did know. Many suspected. But there was no, it was never clear. It was not quite clear to them. Well, so is that, any questions or comments on that? That's very serious business, by the way. One of the things I think is going to hurt American Christians is that American Christians, by and large, play church. We play game. Church. Our church is mostly a fun time. It's usually fun and games. I can say that, but it really is. The general tenor of our church life does not reflect the deadly sobriety and gravity of the issues involved. I mean, when's the last time you went to church? The gospel was preached, the things of heaven and earth were dead, and the things of the death and eternity and judgment to come were dealt with, and you really got the impression that this is a matter of life and death. It just is there. Not that. That's a critical view of it, but I hope I'm wrong. I hope very much I'm wrong. But I think in the end, we often think that in the early Christian century, when the issues were very clear, and when the it was simply a clear-cut decision, vast numbers of Christians gave in. Remember the Donatists and the Novatian heresies? They probably had vast numbers gave in. When the issues were very clear, how many of them remained faithful when the issues are not clear? And see, what communists do, their method is that you don't ask the other side to surrender everything all at once. You ask them to surrender just a little bit. And a little bit they surrender, it shouldn't make that much difference. It's a attrition, they wear down. But this, you look at. Well, let me give you an actual question. What happened to your home church? What happened to the budget in your home church? Well, all of a sudden it became illegal for people to live, to take a tax deduction for the church giving. What would happen?
It would go down.
I think it seriously hurt the church? I hope it wouldn't. I'm afraid it would. Which I use as a, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. When I talk about, I use it as a barometer. The depth of church and perception of our churches. Well, that's my spooky lecture for this quarter. Any questions on Revelation 20? Ezekiel 38 and 39 for a little bit as we saw a reference in the Revelation 20 to Gog and Magog. Set your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, and prophesy against him. And they can say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. Will turn you about and hooks in your jaws, and will bring you out, and all your army, horses, and horsemen, all of them splendidly attired, their company with buckler and shield, and all of them building swords, Persia, Ethiopia, and Put with them, all of them shield and helmet, Gomer with all his troops. Beth Togdamah, in all parts of the north, all his troops, many peoples with you. The enemy from the north, he brings them together for this great battle. And chapter 39 starts out, and you, son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. And then the chapter proceeds with the terrible destruction of God's cords and the burial of them. Now, this, of course, this Ezekiel 30 and 39 are key prophecies made so, not necessarily because of their own nature, but because they are much used by a modern eschatologist from the dispensational school. We are warned, for instance, that since the modern state of Israel is going to be in danger and they're threatened attack by Gog, the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. And there's going to be a great battle. And the forces of good and God are going to win. Now, it's quite a, you read these chapters, we didn't take time to read all of them. These oracles prophesy Israel when it is threatened, and the terrors of heaven are summoned against the Gogian hordes. They are destroyed with torrential rain, hailstone, fire, and brimstone. Then in bitter derision, God, the God of Israel, calls the carrion-eating birds, the buzzards, to the sacrificial feast which he himself has prepared. Discarded weapons serve as fuel for the home fire of Israel for 7 years. Because oil is getting expensive. burial details are 7 months behind in their work. So summarizing here, the nations of the Goyim learn the great lesson they all have to blaspheme the name of Yahweh. And this is very enigmatic. Very enigmatic chapter, and as you probably know, the dispensational school projects this to the future, as they do everything they possibly can, and Lindsay again, we took these hymns as our physical lawyer. Chapter 5, the title of chapter 5 of Lindsay's book, Russia is a God. In space we're going to learn Russia is a God. With the new state of Israel will be, in the future, plagued by a certain pattern of events which have been clearly forecasted. Shortly after the restoration of the Jews in the land of Israel, an incredible angel will arrive to the uttermost north of the northern confederacy. And he goes on to identify this enemy from the north. However, he heard this argument, to draw a line north, straight north of Jerusalem or go through Moscow. It's interesting. The problem with this is that except for Egypt, all of Israel's enemies came from the north. Even though they came from the west, because you know this, don't you? The enemy always came from the north because of the great desert. And then when Babylon attacked Jerusalem, they came from the north. And we're going to see if the enemy is talking about here or not in Russia, but over here in Minor, and we call it Minor. They would come from the north too. So the idea of identifying the enemy by direction, simply comes from the north, that's very silly, because they all come from the north. Understand that? Whether it's other than Egypt. Well, he identifies these people the following way. Gog is the symbolic name of the nation's leader, Magog his land. He is also a prince of the ancient people who are called Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. Now, of course, these are names which go back to Genesis in the table of nations, but here's the identification. You get the various identifications of the following identifications are given by Lindsay, and this is the stand, this is all center dispensationalism. Gog and Magog are the Scythians, the ancient Scythian people who are the people of the north, and the identification is made, the Scythians were people lived under this one of the Black Sea. Very fierce people. The Scythians were the princes in Siberia, Scythian tombs have been found, frozen tombs, and because they were frozen, they are in a marvelous state of preservation. And evidence comes from the Scythian tomb that they practice scalping, for instance. They were buried with their horses. Herodotus tells about Scythians being buried on their horses, the warriors, in great circles. Part of the horses, but this has been confirmed in the Scythian tomb. They were very fierce people. And they were known for that greatness, terrible, very great warriors. Well, anyway, and modern Russians are identified as the ancient Scythians. Meshek is Moscow. You can tell that from the name of the sound. He cites on page 64 of this particular edition of Wilhelm Gesenius, a great Hebrew scholar of the early 19th century, discusses these words in his unsurpassed Hebrew lexicon. Now, as a matter of fact, it has been surpassed, not unsurpassed. Gesenius was a early 1800s, the early 19th century, philologist. And he was writing before the age of archaeology, before the age of cuneiform records. He was working with the information he had. But he cited, as Meshek, he said, was the founder of Moski, a barbarous people who dwelled in the Moskian Mountains. This scholar, look at, I didn't want to cite somebody really abusing me, he's a scholar. Nobody else would know. This scholar would have said the Greek name Moski, derived from the Hebrew name Meshek, is the source of the name for the city of Moscow. Gesenius is the standard source on this. And Rosh, which of course is the German word for head or chief. Of course means Russia, people of the Russian peoples. So that the peoples in general are the Scythians. Gog is the head of the Scythians. Meshek is Moscow, the modern city of the ancient Scythians. And Tubal is Tobolsk, which is a Russian city. Don't take that out, but it sounds nice. Rosh, he cites another scholar, Bishop Lowth of England, in 1710. You guys have this for a minute. He uses the latest scholarship. He starts off with one that's about 1810, goes back another 100 years, to 1710. He wrote in 1710, Rosh, taken as a proper name in Ezekiel, signifies the inhabitants of Scythia, from whom the modern Russians derive their name. That is the general identification. And this is the standard identification. You're familiar with that, weren't you? You probably knew that, did you not? Okay. Cush is supposed to be the Marxist-oriented Black African nation. By the way, Kut is by the way, Kush. Kush Lindsay interprets as being black. Let's see. Who are the allies? Persia, Kush, the Black African nation. He says this. He goes back, he cites Dr. Gesenius again. He was recognized as one of the great scholars of history. We're black men. By the way, Kush is generally translated Ethiopia. He goes on, Persia is... to make a long story short, he identifies Hut as Libya. Gomer is East Germany. You can hear how Gomer and Germany sound very close together. By the way, the way that Lindy identifies it, Gog and Magog are the Scythians in general, in particular, Meshek is Moscow, the city of the Scythians. Tubal is Tobolsk, a city of the fifth. And Rosh is Russia. Persia is the United Arab Republic. Kush is Black African nations. Put is Libya. Gomer is East Germany, interestingly enough. By the way, he goes on. And the picture is that Russia is going to make an alliance with some of the communist nations of Black Africa and with some of the Middle East states, such as the United Arab States, and all of them descend on Russia, on Jerusalem, modern state of Israel. By the way, this is an old theme, the idea of prison. Remember Millerism? I discussed Millerism in the foundational movement in the Seventh-day Adventism and Jehovah's Witnesses. They had the Millerites to sing an old hymn. We are living, we are dwelling in a grand and awful time, in an age on ages telling. To be living is sublime. Hark the waking of the nations. Gog and Magog through the fray. Well, probably this was written about 1810. So far, Gog and Magog have not come to the fray. Or anywhere else. But this is the general approach. To summarize, are you confused, Carl?
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically, what he does is he identifies that this is a modern dispensational thing, which is a very common view, that this Ezekiel 30, number one, Ezekiel 38 and 39 talk about a future, an eschatological battle, our future, a literal battle, and in this, it will be Russia and this general scheme of identification that as Russia, the modern Scythians, modern descendants of the ancient Scythians, and then particularized identifications which, you know, Meshach, Moscow, Tubals, Tobolsk, and Russia's going to form an alliance with East Germany, Gomer, some of the Kush and Put. They're appearing nightly. In North Africa, North African communist nations, and in Persia, the United Arab States, they're all going to come together sometime in the near future upon Jerusalem. Hear that? It's going to be a great battle. It's going to be a nuclear war. That's why they get to the people so long and bearing. It's going to be terrible. The Lord's going to step in and rescue Israel in this. But the fundamental identification, let me sort of cut through and focus you in. The fundamental question of this, fundamental identification is, fundamental question, is it eschatological, is it in our future? Well, it might be three questions. Is it the future, our future, second, is it a literal battle? Or is this apocalyptic language pointed at something that's not literal? Or is it hyperbole? You know? I don't know what that obviously is. Third, is the enemy Russia, the central enemy, the organizing enemy, the Scythian people, with the North? Okay? Is it future? Is it literal? Is it Russia? Okay? That's the basic question. Does that help you? Well, they say yes, it's future. Yes, it's literal. Yes, it's Russia, Scythian people. Now, and I would simply point this very important. Remember I said, and I'm kind of approaching it, remember I said that dispensationalism sort of had to set up its own school, had to go into business for itself because it could not penetrate these established evangelical seminaries of higher learning? Well, we're just going to see this later, but here you've got a guy who's citing two authorities. One is around 1820, the other 1710. How would you like to go to a doctor who's treated you based on medical books, the earliest of which was 1810? Or the latest of which, I mean, was 1810. Would you like to do that? What they do is, this procession, they cite Vesalius. They love Vesalius. They cite Vesalius and the ones before him. And then, as for modern scholarship, well, I mean, that's the primary source. And then when they wanted to cite modern sources, they cite each other. like a liberal, you know, he learned this because of one of the higher education. Liberals have a very interesting way of proving things. They go along in an argument until they get to a gap in the evidence, and jump the gap in the evidence by citing each other. And the liberals got a rule, and nobody's ever written it down or explained it, but they all follow it, and that's this, that you can cross-reference, you cite each other three times, and after the third time it becomes scholarship. That if three of them say it's true, it must be true. And the angels applaud at the great wisdom. But and dispensationalists follow the same scheme. They cite each other, and they cite secondary sources, tertiary sources, and much beyond that. Well, the Scythian people, I've already identified the people, the Scythians I've already identified them as very fierce people. Now, Gesenius identified this, made the basis on etymological connections, sounds. Let's first look at Meshech and Tubal. Meshech and Tubal.
What's spelled
Gesenius? Gesenius? G-E-S-E-N-I-U-S. Now, first of all, the fact is that since Gesenius wrote, and again, Gesenius had little to work with. Gesenius was a good scholar, but what he had to work with. But Gesenius had little more than etymologies to work with, trying to trace language, similarities in sound. Since a lot of information has come available from that part of the world, the ancient world. There's been a veritable revolution. And there have been two schools of learning, among others, two at least, which have been categorically upset by the findings of the great body of cuneiform literature. One school of thought which has been upset by the cuneiform literature and has largely ignored it is the school of radical German theology. You recall the JEDP, Graf Bellhausen evolutionary approach. Well, the basic, the foundational premises of that theory were blown out of the water, and have been out of the water, been dead in the water for a long time, by the work of the Baltimore School of Archaeology, founder of which is William Boswell Albright, and such scholars as Sojourner Wright and Nelson Glick and the others. Wilson and on. Anyway, that's not the subject we're getting at this class. But the point is, they have shown that the fundamental propositions of the Graf Bellhausen scenario are no longer tenable. They cannot be defended. But they're still being taught. And I think I mentioned it before, out of the university. In the history department, that approach was laughed at on the basis of the evidence. It was still being taught in the religion department. Because if three Germans say it, it must be true. And so there has arisen in the field of archaeology and history the two schools, two approaches. There is the one school, which is called the German school, which tends to ignore the archaeological evidence and go ahead merrily on their way. The second school is the British Israeli-American archaeological school, called all three, the British school, the American school, the archaeological school, Israeli school of archaeology, the British, American, Israeli. That is, these scholars, are willing to re-examine and readjust theories based upon the evidence. There's a big war going on now. You want to know the township cannot be abandoned without talking to other facts perhaps, is this, that you have a whole body of scholars who are the architects of the conventional wisdom in that field, whose PhD dissertations, whose academic careers, all the books, his published works, all reflect that basic approach. And that basic approach is found defective. You just wash out the academic respectability of whole departments of universities, especially in Germany and in the East Coast of the United States and Chicago. That is, you simply declare wanting all kinds of dissertations, books, journal articles, academic careers, curriculi, so forth. It's like what would happen to modern biology if people would have taken, except yet this has happened, by the way. You see this in I'm kind of far afield now, but this is college, you'll learn something. You see, we often think that scholars are secular scholars are objective men of science who go where the evidence drives them. Well, I've done business with that. Take my word for it. That ain't so. What happens is that. See, what happened is, and I think you all learned this, that at the turn of the century, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, there was a revolution in scholarship. Everything was reinterpreted. Everything. Biblical studies, theology, comparative religion, psychology, history even, science, certainly. Everything was reoriented to evolution. Everything was reinterpreted, re-explained in terms of progressive development. Everything, Tony. Society, life, there was a biological order, a biological realm, sociological, economics, the communism is just economic evolution. And everything was reoriented within a period of about 70 years. It's a whole new ball game. But, and a whole new basis was laid for psychology, history, science, religion, everything, beginning in Germany largely. Now, that same period, say roughly from 1849, I think Darwin's Origin of Species was published, to say 1920, when I'll just sort of give you some years, it depends on all the time. Roughly that period, everything was rewritten, and a whole new approach to scholarship was created. And in this period, for instance, curriculi, schools, and universities were established. Catalogs were drawn up, PhD dissertations were published, books were written by the ton, and the whole approach was worked out. It was a genuine, cataclysmic, intellectual revolution. Yes?
Excuse me. The school of this radical German society, I understand they stick with Cassanians, they're backing all that.
I'm talking about, that doesn't deal with Cassanians. I'm just speaking in general terms now, approach to scholarship.
They accepted his,
Yes, he was he didn't really count. I'm talking about liberalism now. I'm trying to show you a methodology of approach. And so it doesn't really have anything to do with Cassanians. I'm trying to see the general way of, I'm trying to give you a general concept of how scholarship works and doesn't work. Well, what happened is that this period, say 1850-1920, was also, not only was this the period of rewriting scholarship, it was a period the infant years of hard sciences, biology, chemistry, genetics, even archaeology. And what happened was that these theories were worked out, and basically here's what happened, that these theories, the evolutionary approach to everything, these theories, now listen to me, they became scholarship before the evidence was in. That is, they the evidence, much of it hadn't even started coming in yet, but before the evidence came in, these theories became scholarship. One of the reasons they became scholarship was they offered seemingly intellectual alternatives to the biblical approach. The promise was, in each of these disciplines, well, this is how it works, and the evidence will bear this out. Well, the scientific methodology is that if the evidence doesn't bear you out, you change your hypothesis, right? That's the way it works. The problem is, if the evidence began to come in, it didn't work out. It did not bear out these basic theories. You see, it's an evolution, for instance. The evidence would show, but that it didn't. In fact, you find, for instance, whereas you find scientists, leading, really respectable scientists, convinced of the evolutionary process and the mechanisms involved in 1910, you find them less convinced now. You realize that there are thousands and thousands more creationists in the biology, that is, in the hard sciences, the universities now, more than there were in 1940. In the 1940, a creationist would lose his job at a university campus. He's taught in the area of botany, biology, zoology, physics, chemistry. Now, that's not true at all. As a matter of fact, the head of the zoology department at my university was not an evolutionist when I went there. What's happened? Well, the evidence has begun to come in. And all of a sudden, but why isn't it being accepted? The answer is because it would destroy the structure of modern biology. That is, you would simply wipe out, you might as well drop a bomb on every major university in the country. Well, most of the books become useless. The academic credentials of most of the professors are negated. The textbooks are worthless. In the classroom, the whole, so, I mean, there's too much to lose. When I came down, when I moved down here, the head of the anthropology department, the old godfather at the University of Cincinnati, was on the verge of suicide. The simple reason that the findings of Leakey had made his dissertation and three of his books totally outdated, totally worthless. His whole academic career went down, was almost going down the drain. So they go on teaching it. Same thing happened in the area of history and religion. That is, why do the liberals reject the archaeological approach to ancient history? The answer is, it would simply wipe them off the map. Well, it just wiped out the whole business. For instance, if you accepted the logical conclusions of the American British Israeli School of Archaeology, the religion department at my university, for instance, where I went, the religion department would have to be wiped out and start from it, right, rewrite the curriculum, get a whole new faculty, all new textbooks, add more books to the library, simply dismantle it. And so they don't change it. Now, interestingly enough, the dispensationalists, I like this because dispensationalism, like politics, makes strange bedfellows. Now, dispensationalism and fundamentalism go together. Fundamentalism is a basically non-intellectual approach to biblical truth. And yet, the strange thing is how Lindsay finds himself agreeing with the basic liberal approach to scholarship. I said all that so I can say this. It's very interesting that the dispensationalist, while being fundamentalist, and if anybody hates a liberal, the dispensationalist, I mean, they hate them. And yet, they find themselves agreeing in methodology, to wit, that you ignore the latest evidence in order to preserve your theory. That is, what I'm saying is that Hal Lindsey is using the same evidence that William Miller used. This identification. Well, what William Miller did in 19th century. He died in 1850, something like that. You got that? Using the same sources. Now, does it? That's interesting, isn't it? But what is the latest evidence? Well, the fact is, that the cuneiform records are coming in, and as a matter of fact, whereas Gesenius could not identify on the basis of objective evidence, his identification was based on philological speculation. He sort of worked deductively backwards and guessed at it. The evidence is in now. Well, who are, for instance, do you know that Meshech and Tubal have been identified in the Assyrian cuneiform records? I have it right here in front of me. Text read, this is the age of Sargon. This is the empire which destroyed the northern kingdom. Listen to this. Palace of Sargon, great king, the mighty king, king of the universe, king of Assyria, viceroy of Babylon, he's very humble. King of Sumer and Akkad, the king who, with the help of Asher, god, Nabu and Marduk, other gods, beginning with Yatnatna, that's Cyprus, which is in the midst of the sea of the setting sun, to the border of Egypt and to the land of Mushku, or Meshech. The wide land of Amuru, Hatti, with its entirety, the Hatti land, the Hittites. I'm sorry, the Hatti land, this was Israel, it was called the Hatti land. And all of Gudium, the distant beach on the edge of the Bikini Mountain. He said, I started here, and I went all, put them all in. Now, Mushki, here's another record. This is from the Louvre in the British Museum. Listen to this. This is a cylinder inscription of Sargon again. He's talking about all the land that he didn't mention the Hittites here, which is different from the Hadi land. Strong-arm conquered from Hashmar to Shemesh-Padi, the distant Medes of the east, the lands of the Namri, Alippi, Bit-Habman, Harsuah, the Memean land, Urartu, that's Armenia, Kasku, Tabulum, Tubal, you see, up to the land of Mushki. Now, and the Hittite record that Mushki appeared, you have Tobal and Meshech, Tobal up to the land of Mushki. Well, to make a long story short, it's very clear from the cuneiform record that Tobal, that the Mushki and the land of the Mushki, or Mushki and land of Tabulum, or Tobal, were ancient names of the Phrygian peoples, not the Scythians. Phrygian peoples lived here in eastern Anatolia, as it was called in that ancient period. And a good map shows that this map isn't good. That is, identification, rather than being from the Scythians, as Gesenius said, not the Scythians at all, the Phrygian people. Not up here, not up into Europe, but in Anatolia. It's listed, right? And he lists all these people they conquered, the Hittites and here, and they were Phrygian peoples in eastern Anatolia. Anatolia is area right in here. Well, interestingly enough, Gesenius was wrong. By the way, he mentions Gomer, now Gomer, the ancient Cimmerians, which were a people up in here, the Caucasus Mountains, moved up and down regularly. Herodotus, without going into it, I wrote a whole study on it one time, all I'm pointing out at this point is that the identification, first of all, the identification of Meshech and Tubal as